On the record. On News Talk.
With Pinergy. Supplying energy with insight to forward-thinking Irish businesses.
Now, if you hang around online, then you'll have seen that this week the rather unlikely terms of Westbrit and even more unlikely Castle Catholic have been trending on Twitter for the last couple of days, instigated by a discussion between two public figures. They are two terms which are associated with the beginning of the 20th century, but they are back because there's been real debate on the terms, like whether, for example, they are sectarian or whether it's even appropriate to use them in the 21st century, let alone in the 20th century. But both of these terms have been around for a little bit longer than you might even think. And looking at them now, it maybe allows us a chance to examine language in a broader sense in Irish discourse, particularly when so many of the Acts of Centenary are coming up in the short-term future. So how do some pejorative terms like Jackeen remain in our lingo while others go away? Well, thankfully, one of the prime jacks of our time, Donal Fallon, has wandered into the studio to tell us all about it. I hope you don't take that in an offensive sense.
Not at all.
And the reason why I don't mean it offensively is that until you sent in your notes this morning, I didn't even know that there was a slightly pejorative origin to that. And we'll come to that in a couple of minutes' time. But it does seem, Donal, that recent weeks have suddenly become very much dominated by the past. This must be like a proper historian's Christmas.
It is. It is indeed. And, you know, nothing surprises me now in the latter weeks of 2020. And there's so much focus in recent weeks on commemorating, interrogating the past. We've had Kilmichaelgate, the Bloody Sunday wreath laying.
I didn't know it was a gate, but yeah.
That incredible image of Stephen Cluxton laying the wreath in Croke Park, the anniversary of the burning of Cork, and very meaningful contributions in the media. I think Dermot Ferriter and Claire Byrne was fantastic on the past and how we remember things. And Michael D. Higgins, some great reflections on the centenaries. But I must confess, I was a little bit surprised that these terms somehow trended during the week, you know, displacing kind of popular Netflix programmes and sport. You know, a topic where thousands of people were engaging with these terms, Castle Catholic and Westbrit. But you know what? If we've learned one thing about 2020, the only thing that is predictable in this year is total unpredictability. And that's how it was on Twitter this week.
Yeah, I like even the observation that they were displacing other trending topics, that there was a couple of days there where Paul Pogba was trending and then suddenly, no, it's Castle Catholic. And I suppose one thing that all of this underlines as well, and it's always probably always the case, but this underlines it more than ever, is that the power of words sometimes depends on not what the words mean, but also on who is saying them.
Absolutely, yeah. And, you know, depending on who's saying them, they can mean different things and they can be meant in different ways. So, I mean, for example, the term Brits, you know, The Sun or The Daily Mail might write about, you know, Brits on tour or patriotic Brits or whatever. But in Ireland, the term Brit was something else entirely. It was always meant in a kind of pejorative sense, kind of shaped by the Northern conflict. And it never really meant the average British person, but, you know, generally kind of the British establishment. And the same is true of the word Fenian, you know, which, you know, of course derives from the Irish Republican Brotherhood, the Fenian Brotherhood, but became a kind of pejorative term for Irish nationalists. But Castle Catholic and West Britain, I mean, these terms are, you know, for the most part faded from discourse. It was really, really weird when they popped up. And their origins are kind of wrapped up largely in a kind of culture war. We have culture wars now, of course, but a culture war of a very different time. And I suppose the backdrop of not just political revolution in Ireland, but a kind of cultural revival and cultural tension in the early 20th century. But as we'll get into today, I think actually the origins of these terms, Westbrit, Castle Catholic, might be even a little bit earlier than is sometimes said.
Yeah, your observation about culture war is particularly prescient, because it almost seems like there was a culture war about the culture of a previous war, which I know is a bit meta, but I think that's genuinely where we are. Explain to me then, right, the origins of West Brit, or as West Britain as it was in its original conception. Most people believe that comes from the Act of Union.
Yeah, I mean, the two events which cast the longest shadow over Irish politics both happen in the 19th century. The famine, of course, of the 1840s. What a really brilliant TV series that was on RTE, that two-parter. And we know that had global, like massive global ramifications, put some people in the White House and some people in the poorhouse, you could say. But, you know, the Act of Union 45 years earlier in 1800, that really transforms the relationship between Ireland and Britain. The Irish Parliament is closed. You've got the introduction of the Rect Rule from London. And then the nationalists kind of start referring to Ireland that she's no longer a nation, you know, she's an outpost, or, you know, she's a province. And that wasn't uniquely Irish. The Scottish Parliament had abolished itself decades earlier. And the great Robert Burns, the national poet of Scotland, had written about, you know, Scotland as England's province and condemned those who voted for the Act of Union, a parcel of rogues, he called them. But there was something, I think, more powerful symbolically in the closure of the Irish Parliament than the Scottish one, because Scotland and England, of course, share an island.
Yeah.
You know, the parliamentarians were moving down, if you will, to London, but they weren't going that far. But Ireland was different. Ireland was a landmass without a parliament, if you know what I mean. So, I mean, the perception was that, you know, some looked to the east, you could say. And, you know, political cartoonists and poets, you had these two islands physically separated by water, politically and geographically removed from one another. and they would speak of this East-West divide, and then the term is born. You know, this term that Ireland is no longer a nation. What she is, she's a British outpost. She's West Britain.
Yeah.
And from there derives this term, West Britain.
Yeah, that Britain is no longer just that island, but it's the whole archipelago. It's all of us, that we are all, inverted commas, Britain. Funny thing, actually, that a lot of people don't realise, you know, the reason why they're still allowed to call the larger island Great Britain is because once upon a time, in some British people's minds, Britain was the archipelago. And actually, this island that we're on right now was Little Britain. So if you think about, you know, really now outdated naughty sketch shows, David Williams and Matt Lucas, that you can actually think of it as being a sketch show about Ireland, funnily enough. Unionists did get in on this too, though. They kind of adopted the term West Brit with a certain amount of affinity,
yeah,
and with love. And one person even referred to it by himself in the House of Commons.
I think the first person to christen himself a West Brit was this Unionist MP, Thomas Spring Rice, in the House of Commons. He's very hostile to Daniel O'Connell and O'Connell's campaign for, you know, repeal, bringing back the Irish Parliament. And he says in the House of Commons, I should prefer the name of West Britain to that of Ireland. But I think it's later on in the kind of days of the cultural revival, you know, the early 20th century, the Abbey Theatre, Pierce, all of that, that the term comes to kind of greater prominence. And you get this brilliant political poster, which pops up now and then on Twitter. It's kind of become, you know, memeology. You can change it to say whatever you,
yeah,
want. But it shows Era, Ireland. She's standing tall. And then on the other side is a kind of West Britain, this woman wrapped in a Union Jack shawl. And it says, on what side are you? But it's worth saying, I mean, there's debate during the week, is this a sectarian term, West Brit? I mean, one of the people who used West Britain a lot was Duke Lostahead at Douglas Hyde, you know, himself Protestant. It was a real cultural battle lines remark. And like West Britain, they called George Bernard Shaw West Britain, presumably because he goes to England, he makes his living on the neighbouring island. And Patrick Pearce kind of ludicrously says, as far as the Gael is concerned, Mr. Bernard Shaw belongs to the Legion of the Lost Ones, to the cohort of the damned. I mean, this is one poet talking about another. It's astonishing stuff.
And we thought cancel culture was a new development, and actually Pearce was cancelling G.B. Shaw a good century ago because of which island he was making his living on. That's brilliant. Perhaps there's a more famous, more recent self-styled West Brit, but someone who perhaps took the title a little bit more in jest, was the legendary broadcaster Terry Wogan.
Yeah, and Terry Wogan late in life kind of came to a sense of Irishness, and that often happens. And I think the same can be said of Graham Norton, you know, who went to Britain and then has kind of embraced Irishness in more recent times. But Terry Wogan said on record, I was an avid radio listener as a boy, but it was BBC, not RTE. I was a West Brit from the start. I'm a child of the Pale. I think I was born to succeed in the UK. I have much more freedom than I had in Ireland. So Terry Wogan would have been, I suppose, the archetypical West Brit, as people would have seen it in his day.
Yeah, of course, took on his knighthood later in life as well, Sir Terry Wogan, by the time of his passing a few years back. That brings us then to the other title, which has been trending in the last couple of days. And I must stress, trending rather than trendy. Castle Catholic. And it's probably fair to say that this is perhaps a slightly more loaded or nastier,
yeah,
term.
Yeah, and that's a term that I really, I mean, when I logged onto Twitter and saw Castle Catholic trending, I just couldn't believe it. It's a really nasty term, I think, by comparison to West Brit. And it was a much more kind of serious charge to level against someone. You know, it's not a cultural thing. Like, you call someone a West Briton in the early 20th century because they read Bernard Shaw, you know, instead of reading Irish language newspapers. Yeah. But this term Castle Catholic, it kind of implies that you're part of a garrison class, that you're un-Irish, that you're, you know, you might say the enemy within. And it kind of implied kind of place seeking, you know, because Dublin Castle was the centre of the British administration, but also kind of social aspiration. I think that was what was implied when you were called a Castle Catholic. And, you know, a Castle Catholic is basically perceived to be a clog in this kind of great big British bureaucratic machine.
Okay.
So there's a whole host of terms that come from Dublin Castle in the early 20th century. An informer. If you're an informer in Mayo, working for the local RIC, people still describe you as someone who's in the pay of the castle. You know, the castle is this kind of overarching thing.
Okay.
A journalist who's perceived to be unnational, they call him a castle hack.
Okay.
And Dublin Castle,
this is like the 20th century version of having taken the soup.
Absolutely. And
okay.
I mean, what is Dublin Castle? It's an enormous fortified institution. It's defended. It's behind gates that most Irish people never got through. So, I mean, calling someone a Castle Catholic is like saying you're a part of this great political conspiracy.
Mm.
And it's a term that lingers on, actually, for a little while into the Troubles. Like, John Hume writes of the fear of being labelled a Castle Catholic during the Northern conflict. So there's a real sharp edge, I think, to Castle Catholic that isn't really there in West Brit.
I might be going a little bit off piste here, but I suppose, is it more loaded, or does it carry that little bit more extra venom? Because there's a perception that if you are a West Brit, or if you happen to be Protestant, that there's a sense that you're not of us anyway, that you're not native to these people. Whereas if you're a Castle Catholic, you are someone who's Irish born and bred, but that they've sort of they've taken control of your mind, or that you're one of our own, but you've turned your back against us.
And I think that's what was implied in it. You know, the kind of the idea of the colonized mind or whatever. And there's a real kind of dangerous conspiratorial thing to it too. The Castle Catholic trying to undermine, if you will, the Irish nation.
We mentioned in the introduction that there's some other pejorative terms, and I didn't even myself realize that some of them were pejorative, like jackeen.
It seems that jackeen comes from a kind of pejorative way of describing dubs. So Ian comes from the Irish for small. And Jack from Union Jack. So
okay.
It's similar to Seanean.
So that's where Jack came from.
That's where it comes from. And it's similar to Seanean, which is believed to come from Little John. John being kind of John Bull.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
A Seanean. But Terence Dolan wrote a great book, A Dictionary of Hiberno English, actually back on the shelves for this year with a new introduction from Blind Boy. He talks about it as a pejorative term for a self-assertive Dubliner with pro-British leanings historically. But it pops up really early on. There's a great article in an American magazine in the 1840s about what is a jackeen. And they said the dialect of a Dublin jackeen is as peculiar as everything else about him and as different from that of his countrymen in general outside of the circular roads as chalk is from cheese or bog Latin from Arabic. So it's a term that's been floating around for a long, long time and was kind of used to describe, if you will, a cultural clash between and beyond, I suppose, the canals.
I'm tickled that, you know, in the 21st century we talk about Dublin ending outside the M50. Back in the day they had the circular roads. It wasn't even beyond the canals. You could get as far as the North or South circular roads before you were suddenly outside of the metropolis. Talk to us then about how jackeen became a little bit more reclaimed or was used in a sense more fondly.
They kind of took it back in the 70s and I think it was primarily because, you know, it was used a lot in jest between GAA fans. You have to remember that Dublin kind of came out of nowhere in the 70s under Kevin Heffernan and started doing very, very good. And there was a perception around the country, I think, that these were basically soccer fans who were latching on to the GAA. Okay. So they were like referred to as jackeens. But it's been used in the Dáil. Like a Dáil deputy in 1990 on record says that the dignity of the people is being trampled on by Dublin jackeens who don't understand how small farmers in the west of Ireland operate. So, you know, you get all this talk of Dublin media, the Dublin establishment, if you will, and jackeen was kind of thrown around with that. But then when Dublin are really, you know, finding their feet and finding dominance on Gaelic pitches in the 70s under Heffo, when Heffo's army is there, the banners on the hill, they read, "The Jacks are back." That becomes the slogan of 1970s. The decade of the dubs, as they call it. So a term that was kind of utilised against Dubliners was then reclaimed and kind of ironically embraced on the hill. And you sometimes still see those banners, the Jacks.
Probably inspired Fianna Fáil in 1977 as well, Bring Back Jack as well. what I do love about that is that how it's become so officially claimed that now the nickname of the Dublin ladies footballers is the Jackies. Which I remember the first time I heard that, I was so tickled by it. I think it's just brilliant. This kind of language and questions around terms that might be considered pejorative, it is a global issue, but there's kind of different nuances to it in every other country as
well. Yeah, it's shaped by the political dialogue and the history of every country. And Ireland's not really unique in having these kind of pejorative terms that stick around. In England, those who kind of live within the colonial past and kind of shun the world beyond Britain were long known as kind of Little Englanders. And I think that term really came back actually in recent years.
In the Brexit time. What we've been talking about today already,
And then in the 1850s, you know, the novel Uncle Tom's Cabin in America, that inspired a similar kind of term labelled against black Americans who were kind of perceived to be opposed to the civil rights movement and all of that. But I think there's no denying that the intersections here of language and politics, I find that really, 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 really interesting. But nowadays, Dublin Castle, I mean, we inaugurate our own presidents in Dublin Castle. For me, Dublin Castle is a symbol of the Republic now. And I think Castle Catholic, you know, it's a curious and it's kind of unfitting historical relic and it should probably stay in the past.
One other observation about that, though. We do inaugurate our presidents in St. Patrick's Hall in Dublin Castle, and it's St. Patrick's Hall and it's named after our patron saint, but it's also named after the Order of St. Patrick. And if you go in there, and I've been privileged enough to be in the room for the inauguration of presidents, you do it under the family flags of all the members of the Order of St. Patrick, the royal order of another country, but they're still up there because it would be considered too insensitive or too historically, you know, insensitive or just like it would be historical vandalism to remove them. So we're inaugurating our own head of state, but we're doing it under the family banners of all these other people for an order that doesn't even apply in this jurisdiction anymore. Fascinating stuff as ever. Donald, thank you very much. Great to have you back in studio, by the way. Long may it last. I hope we're allowed to keep this going for a little while longer. Donald Fallon is a historian. He is the author of the Come Here to Me books and he's the presenter of the Three Castles Burning podcast. I'm sure the Come Here to Me books would be a great stocking filler present if you're in the market for that kind of thing this time of year. Donald Fallon, as ever, thank you very much.